I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. It is Monday, March 2nd. Committee, today I'm going to start out by introducing a couple of committee bills to be introduced. So I'll open a work session for the introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1705, dated 3209. LC 3278, dated 3209.
Representative Riley moves that the LC 1705 and LC 3278 be introduced as committee bills. Discussion? Is there any objection in committee? This does not make you
obligated,
that was the word, obligated to support or oppose the bill. Thank you, Gene. I went blank for a minute. The bill is simply to introduce the bill as a committee bill. Without hearing any objections, they are adopted.
It's very irritating.
So with that committee, we have to follow up from Friday's committee hearing on hazardous substances. We have two related bills, House Bill 2367 and House Bill 2792. So it's going to be my intention to go ahead and open both bills up at the same time for public hearing, because I believe we have the same people signed up for both bills, so they can testify to both of them as they see fit, or one of them if they see fit. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2367 and House Bill 2792. Seems kind of loud, doesn't it?
To me, it is.
So up first, I'd like to have Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis and Nina Baker.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee and welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Chair Holby.
Yes.
Chair Holby, distinguished members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm still Renee Hackenmiller-Paradis, as I was on Friday, and I am the Environmental Health Program Director at Oregon Environmental Council. For the record, I have a BS in Cell and Molecular Biology from the University of Chicago, a PhD in Genetics from the University and an MPH in Health Management Policy from Portland State. Oregon Environmental Council supports both HB 2367 and HB 2792, and we are not alone. My work at OEC brings me in contact with the medical field, health agencies, schools and families throughout Oregon, and business people who make and sell products for children. There is overwhelming public support for these bills among these constituencies. In addition, the highly regarded organizations of Planned Parenthood, Oregon Public Health Association, and the Oregon Nurses Association, to name a few, support this legislation. HB 2367 would start protecting our youngest citizens right now by banning the sale of children's products that contain known harmful chemicals, bisphenol A, also referred to as BPA, and six phthalates. HB 2792 provides a smart, common-sense approach to managing harmful chemicals in children's products over the long term. It provides Oregon with information to make informed public health decisions and puts us on the forefront of protecting the health of our children. It's a process with common sense steps that we believe can be implemented with limited resources. We feel that HB 2792 could be strengthened by the inclusion of the Department of Environmental Quality in the determination of priority chemicals and participation in Interstate Chemical Clearinghouse. HB 2792 is not asking to ban or label particular products, but provides a needed framework to determine the scope of potential problems and then develop informed public health policy to address the problem if action is warranted. By moving in this direction, Oregon is not alone. Passage of HB 2792 gives us the opportunity to join Washington State and Maine, who have already passed similar legislation, and to join a half a dozen other states with similar bills up for vote this session. Fortunately, states are taking action where the federal government has failed to protect children from harmful chemicals in everyday consumer products. States are adopting bills like HB 2792 before you today because the infiltration of synthetic chemicals into our daily lives is growing so fast and so unmanaged. So just a few minutes on what is the problem. There's an estimated 80,000 synthetic chemicals used today in the United States. There's 1,000 more added each year. Complete toxicological screening data are available for just 7% of the chemicals out there. Many of these chemicals persist in the environment, accumulate in the body fat, and remain in our bodies for decades. Many have never been tested for their effects on human health. This pervasiveness of these untested chemicals is even scarier when we talk about children. Children have greater exposures to chemical dangers than adults simply because they act like children. They are where toxins settle, on the floor, on the ground, putting fingers in their mouths and clinging to things. And even more importantly, because children's bodies are small and their organs are still developing, chemicals have an easier time of causing disruption. Exposure to hormone-disrupting chemicals during critical times in development, even at very low doses, can result in lifelong adverse health effects. In November 2007, the Oregon Environmental Council published the results of chemical testing of Oregon men and women from both rural and urban areas. The study called Pollution in People revealed the frightening fact that every adult person tested had at least 9, as many as 16 toxic chemicals. And every Oregonian study was contaminated with a toxic specifically addressed in the other bill, HB 2367. 100% of the participants were contaminated with phthalates and 80% contaminated with bisphenol A. So we can deduce that every child would also have these chemicals in their body. So what is a phthalate and what is BPA? And why is it so bad to have them in our bodies and the bodies of our children? Phthalates are chemicals that are found in many consumer products, including rubber ducks, other children's bath toys, and teething toys. They're used to soften plastics and bind fragrances to products. Phthalates are endocrine disruptors that increase the risk of early puberty in girls, have been linked to reduced testosterone levels, lowered sperm counts, genital defects in baby boys, and testicular cancer in young men. Bisphenol A is used in the lining of cans, baby bottles, and sport water bottles. The evidence about bisphenol A and its many effects on human health is convincing and growing. Studies founded by the chemical industry say it's harmless. Non-industry studies show it's a powerful hormone disruptor linked to breast cancer and other negative health outcomes. Just last week, Canadian researchers gave us another reason to avoid plastics made with BPA. Emerging science shows that the hormone-disrupting chemical, thought to quickly be processed by the human body, sticks around in newborns. Because newborn systems can't detoxify and excrete the chemical, BPA can build up in their bodies to 11 times what an adult would experience. Last year, Canada added bisphenol A to its toxic substance list and announced a ban on plastic baby bottles made from it. Many researchers are worried that through exposure to bisphenol A, people are getting what amounts to an extra dose of estrogen. Animal experiments have found that the chemical is associated with hormonal conditions, such as early onset of sexual maturity in females and breast cancer, particularly when exposures occur during fetal and non-fetal periods. U.S. government toxicologists at the National Institute of Health last year expressed concern that bisphenol A may have harmful effects on the development of the prostate and brain and induce behavioral changes in fetuses, infants, and children. Even in adults, we are now discovering that bisphenol A may remain in the body longer than previously thought. Scientists now believe that BPA may get into fat tissue from where it may be more slowly released. In a 2008 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of the top medical journals in the world, showed that high levels of bisphenol A in the body are linked to heart disease, diabetes, and liver enzyme abnormalities. And while some opposed to this bill may question the conclusions or methodologies of these studies, the tidal wave of peer-reviewed research from top-notch research institutions around the country can no longer be dismissed as bad science or flawed methodology. If you hear these claims, consider the source, and then ask for proof that these chemicals do not cause harm. What unique tools and experimental methods do those that claim safety use that are superior to the methods of our best scientists that have shown harm? The claims that bisphenol A have been safely used for 50 years are irrelevant. Just because something has been used for a long time does not mean it is safe. Our scientific understanding of how chemicals impact biological processes has grown exponentially over the past five decades. We now know that death and cancer are not the only negative impacts of exposure to toxins. Reproductive abnormalities, learning disabilities, asthma, and neurological disease are just some of the broad categories of disease that are now known to, at least in part, have environmental contributors. Low-dose exposures do matter. The dose does not always make the poison. In particular, the impact of endocrine synthetic hormone disruptors, such as bisphenol A, can alter the delicate balance of hormones in our body and have lifelong impacts such as breast cancer and neurological disease. We've sequenced the entire human genome and are now beginning to understand the subtle yet crucial interactions between our hardwired DNA and the environmental factors. Advanced scientific tools are demonstrating how exposure to toxic chemicals in our environment can influence gene expression patterns and biological processes. We know that we can make toys and baby bottles without these chemicals. Some of the largest national retailers selling in Oregon, like IKEA, Toys R Us, Walmart, Target, and Kmart, have already stopped carrying children's products with phthalates, and it's the same for bisphenol A. In the past year, as the scientific evidence supporting the health impacts of bisphenol A exposure has increased, there's been a major market movement and backlash away from bisphenol A among baby and water bottle companies, as well as retailers in both the U.S. and Canada. Walmart, CVS, Toys R Us, Nalgene, Playtex, and Whole Foods have or are planning on phasing out bisphenol A-containing products. Companies and retailers removing phthalates and bisphenol A from their products and shelves now show us that safe and cost-effective alternatives are not hard to find. They are available and on the market today. But until every product is free of these toxic chemicals, parents are still left with confusing choices. What parents want to know is that all products are phthalate and bisphenol A-free before they go into a store. And the great thing about 2367 is that it would make sure that the busy parent who goes to the store and faces a wall of baby bottles and sippy cups would know that all their choices on the wall are safe ones. We've been waiting for the federal government to do something about this for over 30 years, and nothing has happened. Oregon has an opportunity to take a leadership stance and protect children's health. We urge you to support both HB 2367 and HB 2792, and thank you for your time and consideration of these two pieces of legislation.
Thank you. And if you'd like to go ahead with your testimony before we ask any questions, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Absolutely. Chair Holvey, distinguished members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Nina Baker. I'm an investigative journalist and the author of a current affairs book entitled The Body Toxic, How the Hazardous Chemistry of Everyday Things Threatens Our Health and Well-Being. Before writing my book, I spent more than two decades in daily journalism as a national business writer for United Press International in New York.
Excuse me for just a minute. If you could move that mic just a little bit away from you.
Oh,
you're
sure.
Just a little too close to it. Thank you.
Okay.
They're very sensitive.
Okay. I was a national business writer for UPI in New York. I was a reporter for the Oregonian, and I was a senior journalist for the Arizona Republic. My interest in the topic of controlling environmental pollutants, such as phthalates, bisphenol A, and other toxic substances addressed in my book, comes from my role as a news gatherer. A few years ago, I learned that the U.S. Centers for Disease Control was beginning to track chemical pollutants found in a representative sample of the U.S. population. I was fascinated by the broad questions this information raised. As a journalist, I wondered, should citizens be concerned about the traces of flame retardants, pesticides, plasticizers, and stain repellents that the CDC measured in virtually all Americans? Were sofas, cookware, and carpeting, and dozens of other commonly used items inside our homes and offices responsible for the pollutants that were ending up in people? How is it that every baby born today has dozens of toxic chemicals inside his or her tiny body? And finally, is government adequately overseeing the use of toxic substances to ensure that all Americans are safe from daily doses of hazardous chemicals? The answers to these questions truly stunned me and are the reason for my book, which I spent 4 years researching and writing. What it boils down to is this. In our headlong rush to embrace products that have made our lives so easy and so convenient, no one stopped to insist that we understand the toxicity of hundreds of commonly used molecular marvels. And the result is that virtually every single one of us is contaminated with traces of chemicals that can interfere with our health and well-being from the moment we inhale our first breath until we exhale our last. These chemical exposures and their link to an array of devastating diseases that are so costly to individuals, families, and communities demand that we act forcefully to limit exposures to chemicals of known concern, such as phthalates and bisphenol A. At the same time, we must encourage the development of greener, cleaner chemicals for use in consumer products, especially those intended for infants and young children. Biomonitoring data from the CDC and other benchmark information, including a 2007 report on the chemical body burden of 10 Oregonians, tells us that many of the chemicals we have put into our bodies, put into our products, have unwittingly ended up in us, specifically in our fatty tissue, our blood, including umbilical cord blood, and our breast milk. Some of these chemicals are so persistent that they are detectable in humans decades after we determine they're no good for us and decide as a society to stop using them. I know this firsthand from my own body burden screening, which was done as part of my book research. Because biomonitoring requires such sophisticated equipment, it's very expensive. My test cost $2,000 and was performed by a highly specialized lab in the United Kingdom. It found more than 36 toxic chemical substances in my blood, including traces of the pesticide DDT and the industrial insulators known as PCBs, both of which were banished in the 1970s when I was a teenager. The persistence of these chemicals in the environment means they're part of the food web and still contributing to my body burden and everyone else's. The good news is that biomonitoring by the CDC shows the levels are going down, confirming the wisdom of our long-ago ban. The not-so-good news is that a far greater number of chemicals measured in my blood, including brominated flame retardants and perfluorinated stain and water repellents, continue in widespread use, even as our knowledge about their hazards grows. Last week in Washington, D.C., a panel of experts testified before a House of Representatives subcommittee that the U.S. chemical regulatory system is failing to protect public health and the environment, a conclusion that I also draw in my book. Lisa Jackson, the new administrator of the EPA under President Obama, has made managing chemical risks one of her top priorities, on par with greenhouse gas reduction, toxic waste site cleanup, improving air quality, and protecting America's waters. Here in Oregon, we have an opportunity under House Bills 2367 and 2792 to protect our children from needless exposures to bisphenol A and phthalates and to identify a list of high-priority chemicals that can be substituted in favor of safer alternatives. These are common-sense steps that will make life better for every Oregonian today and for generations to come. You can make Oregon a leader in reducing unnecessary exposures to toxic chemicals by approving these bills. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Your testimony. Questions, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question on your second page. I don't understand what this means. The report on the chemical body burden of 10 Oregonians.
Right. That was actually a report that Dr. Paradis referenced. It was conducted, sponsored in part by the Oregon Environmental Council, and it was a study that measured a number of chemical contaminants in a blood draw from a group that Renee's organization put together. And what it found was that there were a number of substances in the blood of these people, a number of chemical pollutants that were not dissimilar to what the CDC was finding in their broader representative sample of the U.S. population, or not dissimilar from what I saw when I had my own body burden screening done as part of my research.
Follow-up. I don't understand the phrase body burden.
Okay. Each of us, because of just living and breathing in the world, are exposed to a number of things on a daily basis. The foods we eat, the water we drink, and most relevant to this committee, the consumer products that we use all contain certain contaminants. And these contaminants are ending up in people. We know that as a result of biomonitoring. So every individual has what can be described as a chemical body burden. The phthalates that are in me may not be the exact same phthalates or levels that are in you, but we each have a chemical body burden that reflects how we live, where we grew up, what we eat, what we drink, and so forth. And so chemical body burden is a way of just describing the chemicals that are in each individual.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I just want to make sure that I heard you correctly. Did you suggest that the burden from a regulatory standpoint should be to prove that the chemical does not cause harm rather than to prove that the chemical does cause harm?
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard. What I was suggesting that you will sometimes hear from people opposed to such regulation is that we have no proof of harm. And I would say, I suggest that you throw that, turn that around and ask for their proofs of safety. So I'm not saying that scientifically, scientific method, you cannot prove anything conclusively, right? You have to go on the weight of the evidence. But an oft-touted disclaimer to taking this kind of regulatory action is that we have no proof of harm. And so that's what I'm suggesting in that comment.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I think that were we to change the standard across the board on safety issues to placing the burden to prove that no harm would be done, I think we would find that that would take it would increase costs dramatically, and I think it would also remove a lot of products and things from our shelves. Because as you were saying, it's very difficult for a manufacturer to prove. It's just a totally different burden of proof to say you have to prove that it can do, that it does no harm, rather than have the burden of proof be that it does do harm. I guess that's not really a question, but I thank you for answering that. Mr. Chair, I have a few more questions.
Another question?
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, it's my understanding that there's been a federal law passed in 2008 that creates somewhat of a preemption here, and that it may not necessarily be legal for the state of Oregon to ban some of these phthalates, and that we would find ourselves in court on this issue because the federal government has already passed a preemption law. Are you aware of this?
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard. Yes, I am aware of the law, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008, and they did address lead and some of the phthalates. I am not a legal expert by no means, and so the details of what would be preempted under federal law versus what would additional coverages might happen from our law, in all honesty, I don't have the legal expertise to understand some of the details of how children's products would be defined versus on a state level versus a federal level. I do know that bisphenol A is not covered under the federal law, so there would be no federal preemption issues around that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
One more follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the list of chemicals that you have in 2367, I see DINP, and it's my understanding that, as just one example, the DINP is preempted by federal law. So I guess my concern here is that by passing this bill, we put ourselves in a situation where we would be spending taxpayer money in court only to lose, waste a lot of people's time. That'd be one concern. I do have some more questions, but if the chair is not amenable to that, I'll yield.
Well, see if anybody else has a few questions. We have a lot of people to testify, but certainly don't see any other questions, so go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, it's my understanding the Consumer Product Safety Commission is studying phthalates, and that they have actually them finished, but they have reached some conclusions. And if I can refer to my notes here, after 4 years of looking at it, they concluded, quote, no demonstrated health risk, end quote, from its use in toys, and quote, no justification, end quote, for banning its use. Is that your understanding of their conclusions to date?
Chair Holdy, Representative Wingard, just a clarification on that. I believe you're referring to bisphenol A and not phthalates, the phthalates.
Mr. Chair, I was referring to DINP.
I do know that the DINP phthalate, which is one of the phthalates in question here, is part of a temporary ban that's under the Federal Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. That's as far as my knowledge on where the Consumer Product Safety Commission stands on that.
Okay, one last question, Mr. Chair.
Good.
You had mentioned Washington State moving ahead on this, and it's my understanding that the Washington State Department of Ecology moved forward on some agency rulemaking after this, and I assume in compliance with a bill, and that ultimately, because of this same preemption issue, they've had to withdraw that rulemaking. Are you aware of that situation up in Washington State?
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard. I am aware of that situation. As far as the ban, the substance ban and how theirs was worded, they have decided to go with what the new federal law implemented. They are still moving forward with their equivalent of HB 2792, which is the process bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Wagner.
This could be for either one of you. I was just going through, just because in both testimonies I'm kind of putting things together, and it just bugs me when I walk back to high school and I coach wrestling and different things like that, that all these kids are bigger than me nowadays. And I see you're saying hormone disruptors, and I think that's, I thought it was hormone and chicken we were feeding them was the problem. But this says it can be substituted in favor for safer alternatives. What are some of the alternatives for the BPA?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I'm not a chemist, but I am a consumer, and I do know that when I walk into any grocery store or any drugstore these days, I can go to the baby bottle aisle and find the major baby bottle producers selling exclusively, well, pretty much exclusively, bisphenol A, BPA-free products. I do know that recently I purchased a Nalgene bottle that was free of bisphenol A, or I believe it was because that's what the label told me. So industry has responded very quickly to a demand from consumers to address these concerns based on the accumulating number of studies that suggest we have reason for looking for safer alternatives.
Would you happen to know what those chemicals are using, our doctor?
Chair Holdy, Representative Wider, I am not a chemist either, and I don't know what those substitution chemicals are, but can I show you something real quickly? So I went to the store this morning, and one of these bottles contains bisphenol A, and the other does not. So I know that they can make a baby bottle without it, but I know that baby bottles still have them in there. I do this stuff every day, telling people what to look for, and I still had to spend 20 minutes looking, trying to figure out which one was the bisphenol A-free one and which one had bisphenol A in it. So I don't know what the chemicals are. I know that you can make a baby bottle without it, and the reason I know this one is because at least that's what the label told me was the case. This one I know has bisphenol A in it, or I assume it does, based upon some characteristics that it has. So I don't know what the chemicals actually are. And when we say safer alternatives, the safer alternatives are based on the current science, and I will tell you that that is not to say that 20 years from now we won't find out that those chemicals aren't also contributing to some problem, but I feel we need to make our public health based upon the current scientific evidence we have and move forward from there.
Your conclusion got me there. Thank you.
Appreciate you bringing this forward, and appreciate your testimony on the issue as well. Thank you for your time and appearing here today.
Thank you very much.
Next up, I'd like to bring up Gail Shibley from Environmental Health and Kevin Masterson from Department of Environmental Quality.
Mr.
Well, welcome to the committee. I appreciate you coming forward to shed some light on these bills for us, and I recognize that you're not testifying on in favor, I don't believe, or opposed to the bills, but I may be wrong. So you can help clarify that for me, if you wish, as you go forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's a delight to be back with you again today. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. Gesundheit. I believe, have for the committee copies of testimony for both HB 2367 as well as HB 2792. I also provided for the committee, apropos, I realize this bill is not in front of us today, but apropos the discussion from last Friday afternoon as well as the discussion today, as I continue to share with the committee and we discuss the public health approach to dealing with environmental contaminants, particularly chemical exposures, literally hot off the press is one of my environmental health journals from one of section of CDC on the public health approach to chemicals exposures, and so I wanted to share that with the committee. Also, before I make a comment about the bills, there was a lot of very appreciated on my part concern about the capacity within my office and within the state of Oregon to deal with environmental public health from a scientific standpoint, and I did a quick kind of round number examination in my office, and there are about 12 health physicists in my office, 3 PhD toxicologists, 3 epidemiologists, 5 public health educators, 11 research analysts, and about another dozen or so environmental health specialists, and still another dozen natural resource specialists dealing with things like safe drinking water and so on. So we respect science a lot. We depend on it all the time, and thank heavens there are certified smart folks behind me literally are the backbone of our public health protection. Mr. Chair, HB 2367, I am indeed here to testify in support of. As I understand it, it makes an unfair trade practice to sell a product that contains various formulations of phthalates as well as bisphenol A. And it is this precisely the kind of exposure that that we have been talking about in terms of children being exposed to these chemicals, particularly when you look at products that are designed to be in children's mouths and used repeatedly with repeated washing and heating. These kinds of chemical compounds can leach or off gas out of the products over time. The studies regarding early exposure to BPA affecting reproductive gland and organ development is of concern from a public health standpoint, as is so-called phthalate syndrome. It's represented by various anomalies in laboratory animals as well as wild animals and fish. The synergistic effects, the additive cumulative effects, the so-called body burden that was discussed previously, all raise the continuing level of risk concern from a public health standpoint. I'm not here to testify regarding the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008 that was passed last August, I think without a single vote in opposition, if I recall. I could be wrong about that. I maybe think of another bill. But that act did, in fact, put new federal limits on 3 types of phthalates, placed temporary prohibitions on 3 other types of phthalates, and one of those, the DINP, has been a focus of some particular concern in the scientific literature because of the concern about interference with the synthesis of testosterone, and therefore concern
concern about permanent effects on the sexual development of male infants. And for those reasons, we support this public health precautionary principle in action through 2367. Regarding 2792, we are very supportive, as I've stated over and over again, of this kind of principle of precautionary principle, trying to reduce risk, knowing that there is no absolute zero, nor is there any absolute threshold above which something is either absolutely safe or absolutely not safe. However, this bill, though it is self-funded, quote-unquote, there is a funding mechanism in this bill. Neither the position authority nor the other funds limitation are contained in the governor's recommended budget, which has been submitted to this legislature, and so we are not taking a position formally related to the FTE and the dollars associated with this bill. I'm speaking from a policy standpoint. I do want to share that from a state standpoint, and I think Kevin would concur with my perspective on this. This is really a very exciting time to be working with not only colleagues at the within the same state at the state level, but between states and among states. I know that my colleagues at DEQ, like I, have been in close and very continuing and collaborative communication work with our colleagues all over the country. And Oregon is not alone. I think the National Conference of State Legislatures tracks these kinds of legislative proposals. And, in fact, other states are, depending on how you want to count it, ahead of us, so to speak, in terms of actually enacting legislation focused on this. Maine, I think, did a year or two ago. Michigan, Massachusetts, Washington, California, a variety of states are really trying to identify what is the concern within the state, at the same time working with other states to work collaboratively, not reinvent the wheel, not set 16 different standards, so make it difficult and overly challenging for folks to do business. But we all have the same goal in mind. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to testify regarding both these bills.
Thank you. If you'd like to provide us your testimony now, identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holby and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Masterson. I'm the agency toxics coordinator for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2792. DEQ is currently developing a comprehensive toxics reduction strategies that is designed to focus the agency's efforts on toxic chemicals of highest concern for human health and the environment. Establishing a list of high-priority toxics will allow our agency to attain the greatest level of environmental protection in the most cost-efficient way. The information generated on toxic chemicals and safer alternatives under House Bill 2792 will assist DEQ in achieving that objective. Recent monitoring studies of toxic chemicals in the environment have shown that there are commonly found consumer products and chemicals in consumer products, including children's products, that are detected in ground and surface waters both in Oregon and around the country. These chemicals enter the environment through the discharge of those products through the sewer after consumers get done using them, as well as to the solid waste landfill when they're discarded as garbage. Once widely dispersed in the environment, these chemicals could pose potential risk to human and ecological life. So there is a link to public health and environmental protection through the discharge of these materials into the environment. DEQ does have some programs to assist businesses and individuals reduce the use of highly toxic chemicals. However, the challenge is that most federal and state environmental regulations are focused on the proper control, treatment, and cleanup of toxic pollutants. And our strategy, the new strategy that we're developing right now to reduce toxics, will place a greater emphasis on reducing those pollutants at the source, which is a much more cost-effective and environmentally protective approach than managing the pollutants once they've entered the environment. House Bill 2792 will advance the goal of reducing toxics at the source by encouraging the replacement of toxics of high concern with safer alternatives, and by generating information on the availability and relative toxicity of those alternatives. DEQ and the Department of Human Services, as Gail alluded to, have begun to work with other states to develop ways of sharing information on toxic chemicals as well as safer alternative assessments. These efforts that we're embarking on with other states can avoid duplication of work and create a larger network of data and information sources. By authorizing our participation in an interstate clearinghouse, House Bill 2792 will accelerate the exchange of critical information with our state partners, advance toxic chemical and pollutant reduction activities in Oregon, and save scarce state resources. Should House Bill 2792 become law, we look forward to working with DHS and other state partners in implementing the legislation for the benefit of Oregon citizens and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Wingard.
Gail, I want to ask the same question of you. I know you kind of indicated you weren't prepared to talk about the federal legislation, but I am concerned about any bill that we would pass that would put us in conflict with federal law and essentially tie us up in court, cost taxpayers money to achieve no result.
And Representative Wingard, before she answers that, it's my intention to have Legislative Council address that aspect of this bill. So instead of asking people that really can't give us a legal opinion on that, I think it would serve us well to get the legal opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that assurance from you of a legal opinion, I'm satisfied. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Gail, have you studied the BPA, or do you have chemists on staff that have looked into BPA?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Widener, I don't have a chemist on staff. All of those, the epidemiologists, toxicologists, physicists, and so on, do not include chemists. We do have risk assessors, PhD toxicologists, who have indeed studied phthalates and bisphenol A.
So, just going through and stuff I looked at, my wife and I actually, we've stopped using plastic for heating up food and things like that because we heard that that is an issue. But I'm just wondering, I was just looking at different studies knowing this was coming before me, and I pulled one up where adults seem to process BPA much faster than infants or up to 3 years of age, I believe. It's 3 months or 3 years. At 3 months, it speeds up. But they found that there wasn't a lot of damage done to adults because it was processed fast through the urine and excreted quite quickly when they were taking in BPA from plastics. I don't know if you've looked into those studies or evaluated them for this bill.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Widener, I don't know which studies you're referring to. I tend to only read the executive summary of these very academic studies because I couldn't do much more than that. But what I can tell you is that what your characterization is very much in keeping with what is known about fundamental differences between infants and adults. From a regulatory standpoint, typically, historically, what the federal government has done is take a look at an individual chemical and assess its risk on a 70-kilogram adult male. There are a lot of us who are not 70-kilogram adult males, and perhaps among the most unlike that would be a very small infant, pound for pound. And the reason I say that is not just to be silly about it, but children, infants, are not simply small adults. Pound for pound, they breathe more air, they drink more fluids, they take in more food, and so they just have... And that goes along with the very fast cell division that is occurring at that particular stage of life. And so it's at that, when you start compounding these potential risk factors, it is for that reason that from a public health standpoint, we particularly are concerned about exposures for children and developing fetuses. So your characterization of that particular study is very much exactly in keeping with that paradigm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gail, one question for you on House Bill 2367. So your department has toxicologists and scientists that review, going back to the peer-reviewed studies on chemicals or risks to humans' health, I suppose. So of the chemicals identified in House Bill 2367, do your toxicologists tell you that they believe there is a risk to human health with or from exposure to these specific chemicals, especially to children?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's it's a very good question. I'm not sure that it has a question or it has a very satisfying answer. The capacity that we have on staff is tend to be focused on the things that they are funded to do. That said, when we are confronted with issues and questions, we often, because we are so immersed in the scientific literature for a whole range of things, we either go out and try to respond to a specific question, or we just come across it as we do all the time. And I've shared just some of the things in the last couple committee meetings. That said, I believe I'm correct in saying that these 3+3 particular compounds of phthalates are among those most commonly identified in the literature. Scientists, chemists are wonderfully inventive people, and so I don't pretend to know how many other kinds of compounds of these phthalates either are already in mass production in a variety of products, or how to rank one versus the other. But I do know that the DEHP, the DINP, the DBP, the BBP, etc., that these are ones that we do see in the scientific literature. For us to be able to make a conclusive statement that, based on our reading of those studies, because we don't do the research ourselves, that the weight of the scientific evidence equals a public health concern, I'm not prepared on behalf of the department to make that statement today.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Gail a question.
Come on, ask Kevin.
I will. If he'll allow me, I'll ask him one time. From a policy standpoint, you're testifying, so I understand that. But from a policy standpoint, if a bill like 2792 went through, do you see... No, 2367, sorry, the other one. Do you see something like this more appropriately being enforced, if we went there, by DCBS or Justice, or... Because I don't know a lot, I'm learning about your area, but do you already have this kind of activity going on in terms of enforcement of this kind of thing, interface with manufacturers, retailers, and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we have some very long-standing authority, which I shared with the committee on Friday, 453-005. Et sec. This, I think, is housed in the DOJ statute. The 2367 is as an unlawful trade practice. I frankly, it would take at least one, perhaps more than one, discussion with my professional colleagues in both of those departments to really be able to answer your question very satisfactorily. I will share that over the few years that I've been around this building, that you notice how long this list is regarding trade practices. So clearly either this is a handy way to do it, or it's a very effective way, or both, because the list always gets longer. It never gets shorter or gets moved.
Additional questions?
Representative Gilliam, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask you, and I'm sorry, you didn't give us testimony, so I've forgotten your name.
Kevin Masterson.
Kevin, with DEQ.
Correct.
That wasn't my question.
Follow-up question.
What? Just tell me a little bit about DEQ's relationship to, and I know this is, I'm talking about 2792. This has got implications nationally, but just in Oregon, do you have a relationship with manufacturers, potential manufacturers of these companies? Are there any in Oregon? And if so, we identified them, communicated with them. I'm always interested in what we're doing on the volunteer side before we come in with a hammer. And can you say something about DEQ's relationship with those companies or potential companies?
Chair Holby and Representative Gilliam, that's a good question. We do work with manufacturers of various products in Oregon. There aren't a lot of chemical manufacturers in Oregon, obviously. In terms of companies that use these types of products that we're talking about here today, I'm sure there are many companies that do. And we have been working with them for years, 20 years, in fact, through the Toxic Use Reduction and Hazardous Waste Reduction Program, which is primarily a voluntary technical assistance program. It's a program I used to be involved in. We do have a record of being able to identify a lot of safer substitutes, although some of them will tell you that they've kind of hit the wall with certain products, being able to find substitutes that are as effective. And of course, that is very important for all of our businesses, that if they're going to have safer substitutes, that they work as well. So there is a long track record of DEQ working with businesses, manufacturers, and other businesses who use those products that have chemicals of concern to try to find safer alternatives or use those chemicals and products more judiciously so they don't get into the environment. So I think that would continue. One of the things that we're concerned about is that there isn't a huge volume of information on some of these emerging contaminants. We know a lot about DDT and PCBs, and the other chemicals have been around for years and years. It's more about some of these newer chemicals that have some chronic sublethal impacts that we're just starting to find out about. And so better information that this bill would generate would be helpful in helping us prioritize what to work with in terms of our business technical assistance programs. That would be extremely helpful, as well as information generated on safer alternatives. Again, in some cases, we've hit the wall and we don't have good alternatives to offer. So to accelerate the look into green chemistry, I think would be beneficial for the state as a whole.
Thank you. Mr. Master, and I also, you're done, Representative Gilliam?
I am for now, sir.
Thank you. I also recognize that you did mention that you were testifying in favor of 2792, and I would appreciate if you were able to provide us a written testimony at some point, if you could get that to our committee administrator. I'd like to keep moving. I've got a lot of people still signed up to testify, and I don't want to stay here past 6. So with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I did fail to mention that on page 4, line 31 of HB 2792, I did want to voice support for Dr. Hackenmiller-Paradis's comment that DHS, in partnership with DEQ, for us to share that authorization to participate in the interstate clearinghouses is terrifically acceptable to us.
Thank you. So noted.
Thank you.
Seems like it would be a cost-effective thing for our agencies to coordinate and cooperate whenever possible. So with that, I'd like to bring up some other testifiers on the bill. If I could have Jim Markey, Tim Shestick,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Markey testifying on behalf of American Chemistry Council today. And I have with me Mr. Tim Shestick with the American Chemistry Council. We had hoped to, in addition to Mr. Shastik, have a scientist who specialized in this area with us today, but we were unable to get anyone here. We're hoping that if you have another hearing, we'd like to bring some folks here, because we think that it's very important that you look at the science on both sides of this issue. Before I turn this over to Mr. Shastik, I just wanted to make a couple of comments briefly on House Bill 2367. You have our written testimony. The comments I'm going to make are not covered in that testimony because they speak to the Unfair Trade Practices Act. I know a lot more about the Unfair Trade Practices Act than I do chemicals, I'll tell you that. This bill, I just wanted to point out to you a couple of things. On lines 11 and 12, the bill talks about a retailer selling, may not willfully or knowingly sell, offer, sell. Willfully sounds like a high standard, but there are court cases that have defined willful under Chapter 646 to include ordinary negligence, knew or should have known. So it's not nearly as high a standard as you might think. And secondly, I wanted to point out on page 4, lines 19 through 22, which are the portion of the operative sections of the statute, Section 1 of this 2009 of this act apply to a person that operates as a retailer on or after the operative date of this section. So if I were a retailer who had been in business for 20 years and I sold a product with BPA in it and I was still in business after the effective date of the act, I believe an action could be brought against me. I think the bill is totally retroactive by the way it's structured here. So I think that's something that you should perhaps look at as you, if you decide to move forward with this legislation. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Shastik, who flew up here from Sacramento today just to visit with you folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Tim Shastik with the American Chemistry Council. I'll start with our concerns in opposition to House Bill 2367. We had some discussion about how these products are used and what consumer applications, but just quickly by way of background, bisphenol A is primarily used to make polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. You'll find it in some of the examples given today in terms of water bottles and baby bottles. You'll find it in bicycle and football helmets. And in the epoxy resin universe, you'll find those products used in a variety of different consumer products, painted circuit boards, and primarily in protective coating in most food and beverage cans. Bisphenol A has been around for more than 50 years, and in our view is one of the most tested substances on the market. The consensus, and I want to bring your attention not just to what some of the proponents might have indicated, that only industry-funded studies have deemed these products safe. The consensus among regulatory bodies around the world is that bisphenol A is safe as used, including use by infants and children. Most notably, those government bodies are in Europe. And then in the last year, we've seen updated safety assessments from the European Food Safety Authority, the European Union, the French Food Safety Authority, German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment, and the Danish Environmental Protection Agency. And I also like to bring to the committee's attention a statement that was issued by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration just last month, and I'd be happy to pass out a copy of this entire statement, but let me read just in part. With regard to BPA generally, based on all available evidence, the consensus of regulatory agencies in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan is that the current levels of exposure to BPA through food packaging do not pose an immediate health risk to the general population, including infants and young children. So I think it's important to reemphasize to the committee that it is not just the American Chemistry Council, the producers of bisphenol A, that have indicated and support the safety of these products as they're being used, but it is the consensus of not just the U.S. FDA, but governments across the globe. There was also some discussion earlier about body burden and biomonitoring data. I would encourage the committee to investigate the U.S. Centers for Disease Control biomonitoring program. The American Chemistry Council has been a proponent of that particular program. But if you drill down deeply and taking a look at some of the CDC information and a bit of the disclaimers that are included in the biomonitoring program, they are quick to point out that just because you can identify a chemical in the body, you cannot make a conclusion that chemical does cause disease. The National Academy of Sciences also has made it clear in a recent report on biomonitoring that our ability to measure chemicals in the body far exceeds our ability to understand exactly what that means. So much additional research is necessary. Our ability to test chemicals and identify them to the parts per billion and parts per trillion level is advancing rapidly. So I just caution the committee that just because you have identified chemicals in the body, whether it's through a very unscientific 10-person biomonitoring program in the state or the federal government's CDC program, which is a representative sample of the entire U.S. population, there's a lot of unknown answers to a variety of different questions about chemicals that have been identified in the body at very minute levels. So with those particular comments, I do appreciate the committee's interest in pursuing the legal preemption question. It is our belief that the Consumer Product Safety Act that was passed most recently by the U.S. Congress does preempt states from additional restrictions on the use of phthalates in children's products. If I could also just make a couple of comments regarding House Bill 2792. Though while we do support the intent of House Bill 2792, we must respectfully oppose the bill as drafted on a couple of different points. In our view, the bill as drafted oversimplifies both the core principles of risk assessment and toxicology by merely suggesting that the presence of identified chemicals, whether in biomonitoring studies or in individual products, could pose a risk. We also believe that the concept of chemical substitution and safer substitutes is oversimplified. We also do not believe that the bill takes into account the current regulatory scheme governing chemicals and chemical products, as well as the U.S. EPA efforts to identify and prioritize chemicals for potential regulatory action. And we also have some concerns about a state-based chemical management program that would create regulatory uncertainty for consumer product manufacturers and others that operate in a global marketplace. There's been some discussion earlier about safer substitutes and safer alternatives. In our view, calls for chemical bans and substitutions must include an analysis of those potential alternatives, really on a life cycle basis, with looking into account or taking into account risks, costs, benefits of substitution. And a lot of these different analyses from a life cycle perspective look at engineering, occupational health and safety, energy use, waste production. And in our view, all of these must be considered and spelled out more clearly than the current draft of the bill. We'd also like to bring to the committee's attention some ongoing efforts and newly initiated efforts at the federal level. We encourage this committee and the state of Oregon to examine closely the US EPA's effort to implement its new chemical assessment and management program. Under this program, US EPA by 2012 is seeking to complete screening level hazard and risk characterizations to prioritize and initiate action as appropriate on more than 6,500 chemicals produced above 25,000 pounds a year. Virtually about 96-97% of chemicals currently in commerce. Information gathered on this program will include the posting of risk-based prioritizations, which will summarize basic hazard and exposure information on both high production volume chemicals and medium production volume chemicals. In our view, it makes prudent sense, both from a fiscal and a policy perspective, for states to leverage this type of information instead of implementing an entire separate program here in the state of Oregon. And finally, there were some comments made earlier by the proponents about efforts, recent hearing at the federal level before U.S. Congress on the Toxic Substances Control Act. Just this past week, the American Chemistry Council was a participant in that particular hearing, and frankly did suggest some additional efforts that could be undertaken at the federal level to further enhance and improve the U.S. government's chemical regulatory policy. And really those boil down into a couple of different areas: additional authority under EPA to prioritize and implement, if warranted, additional regulatory scrutiny, and to make available both to manufacturers and end users, hazard and use exposure information, so everybody in the value chain can make additional informed decision-making about particular chemical products. So the industry is active, working with the new Congress in hopes of identifying ways in which to further enhance the U.S. regulatory system as it relates to chemicals. And with that, we would respectfully encourage this committee to vote no on both of these current proposals. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Chair Hobey. Tim, thanks for making the trip up here to be with us today. I was just going through, because you sit back and you're gathering information when you do this. I mean, and I'm not a chemist by any means, even though I played with a lot of chemicals when I was younger. But I guess that probably came out a little wrong than it should.
Don't want to know about
it. It was interesting.
Explains a lot.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, but I chose not to.
More in probably bomb making, other things that the other guys wouldn't like.
I get better, right?
Anyhow. Tim,
digging up a deeper hole.
Before security comes in and pulls me out of here, I'm just going through, and I had stuff, some of the information I gathered said that Canada banned BPA in bottles last year, and this is an article that was published in 2009, and I was just wondering if you knew anything about that.
The Canadian government has indicated that it intends to move forward with a regulatory restriction of some sort for baby bottles, despite the conclusion that the product is safe as used. I'm not aware of the timeline on that. It has not been implemented yet, but they have indicated their intent to move forward with that.
Then follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Have you noticed, has there been anybody out there that you know of that's done tests with the heating of plastic, like with food materials or like a bottle? If lots of people tend to put that in the microwave to heat it up for a baby, if that has an effect, because I know lots of times, like with chemicals, that's part of the process of breaking them down is with heat, with the chemical companies that I've worked with in the industries. And I'm just wondering if you guys have done any studies to see if that pulls some of the BPA out of it when they're heating infant formula or food or anything like that.
I don't have that a specific answer for you right now, but I would point out that when FDA did do its weight of the evidence review of BPA, several hundred citations and scientific studies were looked at. That could be a part of that. I will definitely look into that and get an answer for you. But right off my head, I don't have that for you.
If you have that information, I would really appreciate it.
We will get that. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Krieger.
Just real quick, we've pretty well outlawed copper pipes, and they've gone to a new plastic flex pipe. I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, but you can put it around. What's it made out of compared to the thing we're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, that I believe you're referring to a kind of, it's called cross-linked polyethylene, PEX. It is a polyethylene-based plastic material. The chemical composition of that, I can definitely find that out for you. I don't know off the top of my head.
I wonder what's in it compared to what we're talking about or different concentrations.
I would be happy to look into that for you and provide that information.
Did we outlaw copper?
I don't think it's outlawed, but it's not suggested anymore.
Well, it's just expensive.
So your pipes don't get stolen.
Yeah. I say you better chain them down.
So, other questions of these gentlemen? Before you leave, I just wanted to go back to some of these studies that have been mentioned. I mean, you mentioned some studies as done by industry, I assume, and then we also, you know, had previous testimony of studies done by universities and things. And so, is there any central clearinghouse of all these studies where people look at these and decide which ones are relevant, which ones aren't?
Or, Mr. Chair, I believe that the studies that Mr. Shestick cited were not done by industry; they were done by regulatory agencies throughout the world.
So could I get get a reference of those studies that you're referring to?
We'll bring you copies if you'd like.
Just like to know where they're done, who did them, I guess.
Sure.
So I'm just trying to compare those studies versus the other studies that we have here. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. And I'm not sure that I'm asking the right people, but according to the materials that we have, the Toxic Substances Control Act, part of that, the EPA approves an average of 700 new chemicals for commercial use each year without safety tests, and it's required testing for fewer than 200 of the 62,000 chemicals grandfathered in by the TSCA. And is out of all of those, it's only restricted 5 chemicals. So what can you say to us that would make us feel comfortable that the chemicals that you are talking about, at least the ones that it would be referenced in these bills, that they are safe? It seems like the burden of proof is on the state or the federal government, not on the chemical manufacturer.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Tomei, I'm not an expert on the Federal Toxic Substance Control Act, but there are requirements for new chemicals that enter into the marketplace to go through a pre-market notification process by which EPA has the ability to review data on new chemicals entering the marketplace. And I'd be happy to provide a more thorough analysis, if you will, a background sheet on the U.S. EPA's process for reviewing new chemicals that enter the marketplace. U.S. EPA is also involved in a voluntary program with my member companies and a variety of other chemical manufacturers to produce health and safety data, make that information publicly available through a high production volume challenge program, and all that information.
That's a voluntary program that or anyone else has to be involved in, right? Is that what you're saying?
It is a voluntary program, but at the end of the program's life, we expect data from our member companies and other chemical manufacturers to be available for about 95% of the chemicals on the marketplace. Your question about whether there are assurances that these products are safe, I would go back to the U.S. FDA's review and conclusions that have been made by government bodies around the world that BPA used in these applications is safe. And those are not necessarily studies just produced by individual industry companies or manufacturers, but is a weight of the evidence approach that includes scientific studies have done both by private sector individuals as well as regulatory agencies around the world.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate it. And sure we'll have another hearing on this bill, as you were asking earlier. Next up, I'd like to have Jim Craven and Betsy Earls.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the AOI Retail Council. I've just been informed that ladies go first, so I guess I'll start, probably because I have my testimony in front of me. AOI represents over 1,600 Oregon companies, and more than 300 of those identify themselves as retailers, or they identify themselves as having a retail component to their business. So we're very interested in the bills that are before you today. It is the position of AOI and its retail council that policies affecting a range of products as broad as those affected in these bills is best established at a national level. When a state the size of Oregon, which is located next to a state the size of California, begins to impose unique requirements, as in the bills you see before you, it does create issues for its retailers in terms of being able to access product. Regardless of whether the law allows a substitution chemical in products that are of concern, it is entirely unrealistic for us to think that manufacturers would develop and ship a product that's specially created for Oregon when most of the West Coast market and shipping is driven by California, who does not have these same requirements. This is an issue for retailers that sell children's products, but I think of greater concern to us today is that because of the way especially House Bill 2792 is drafted, it sweeps many, many more products into its regulatory scope. The definition of children's products includes, as you can see, any consumer product containing a chemical of high concern that, when used or disposed of, may result in the child or fetus being exposed to that chemical. That's an awfully broad definition, and I believe that it could be applied to an awfully broad range of products. So I would urge you to consider that definition in the context of the size of a state the size of Oregon, looking to have a broad range of products shipped into it. If the committee is serious about pursuing House Bill 2792, we would urge you to consider narrowing that definition substantially to apply directly to children's products.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Jim Craven, representing Tech America. You know who we are now, so I'm not going to give you the speech. House Bill 2367, most of, I think you've heard, had a good dialogue here today, so I'll hopefully be brief. 2367, which is the BPA phthalates bill, we have a concern. It's identified as focused on children's products, but I'm here today speaking about consumer electronics products. It is a definition that says for the care of or use by a child under 12 years of age or to come in contact with a child under 12 at the time the product is used. I think that opens up a very broad definition rather than, we've heard testimony about baby bottles and sippy cups. I think this definition maybe opens this bill up to a whole range of products. We're thinking of things like educational toys, speak and spell, the kinds of things that we buy for our children that while may be made with certain chemicals, maybe even not these two chemicals that are identified in the bill, we do have that concern about that, the broadness of that definition. So we'd urge you to take a look at that on the specific bill, to take a look at what you're really trying to target and maybe take us out of the target range. On House Bill 2792, the much broader bill, again, the definition, as Ms. Earls just pointed out, talking about anything that when used or disposed of may result in a child or fetus being exposed to that chemical kind of, again, means sort of everything in one way that we read the bill. So again, we, even though it's children's products, but it's children's products, stuff for kids, or anything that's used around kids kind of means anything. So we want you to look at that in your deliberations. But we also want to point out that in the case of our industry, particularly with electronics, there's been a huge movement driven by the European Union in the so-called ROHS, R-H-O-S, restrictions on hazardous substances approved by the European Union in the force of law to which we are complying in the electronics industry. And there was a number of chemicals that were targeted in those ROHS restrictions, and whether we're building products here or other places in the globe, we're not going to build products that are compliant with chemical restrictions in Europe separately from what we're going to build everywhere else. So the Europeans have gotten out ahead on this and are driving the global production of electronics products with a number of specific hazardous substances. And again, it's sort of the claim that we're complying with that and we're being driven by that, and having duplicative standards makes life difficult when you're trying to produce products for global commerce. And finally, the repeated issue you heard both Friday and today about
little old Oregon setting itself up as the Consumer Product Safety Council or the FDA is, I think, a bit of a reach for a small state like this to, particularly in House Bill 2792, which would give the state the authority not just to say you can't sell a product with X in Oregon, but to give staff at the Health Division the ability to re-engineer our products, to say, instead of using chemical X when you make this product, you need to use chemical Y. Now, we heard that the Health Division does have a range of toxicologists and public health people on its staff, but to really carry out the mission that's envisioned in 2792 would require industrial engineers, a host of chemists. I mean, basically, people would have to ask us for our secret sauce on how we make stuff, analyze it, look at the wide variety of chemicals that could be substituted, and redesign our products for us and tell us how to make them for Oregon. So we think that's just a bit of a broad mandate for this agency, particularly at a time when I do not think they have people on staff that could do that task, which would mean the addition of a substantial cadre of people. If you really want staff at the Oregon Department of Human Resources to be re-engineering global products, then that's what we see this bill calling for. In the interest of not just being negative up here, there are some good pieces, I think, if you, not right now, but at your leisure, look at Sections 8 and 9 of House Bill 2792, which authorize the department to serve as a clearinghouse, to provide information to Oregon consumers about products, to even maybe make recommendations about, we think this would be safer than that. I think there's a kernel of some good mission in Sections 8 and 9 to do what Oregon can do, which is gather information, make it available to Oregon citizens, and help drive the debate and participate with other states in that effort, while we maybe defer to the federal government and sort of global agencies like the European Union who are driving the global debate on this subject. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the time.
Questions? Representative Krieger.
Jim, you talked about electronics and when you were talking about, or thinking about computers, computer products, cases, and then the medical equipment in hospitals that are all kinds of devices and personal devices you can buy in a drugstore, female-type things. There's all kinds of coatings, paints, and coverings that are used in those. Here again, do you think some of those devices and products are going to be affected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, specifically by the bills, it's hard to say no, and that's why people asked me to come share with you today. Given the definition and the somewhat broadness and uncertainty of the definition, I understand that both of these bills are couched as children's products, and we're not in the electronics industry. We're not typically in the children's products business if you're talking about baby bottles and sippy cups. But if you're talking about little tape recorders, little electronic educational toys, that's where we are a little uncertain as to where the mission of these bills is going.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, I'd like to have Mae Thompson and Susan Katz.
Chairman Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Susan Katz. I'm a physician and a pediatrician. I specialized in working with children with behavioral and emotional problems in McMinnville for 20 years, both in the public and the private sector. I'm now retired. I'm here today representing Physicians for Social Responsibility, where I am on the board and a member of the Environmental Health Committee. I've had a special interest in following recent research into the effect of environmental toxins on neurodevelopment in infants and children, and as I've followed that, I've become very interested in the endocrine disruptors as well. I strongly support the proposed legislation. Firstly, we need to know what is in children's products. Manufacturers should have to disclose whether or not a chemical of concern is being used in a specific product. Now they don't. Then we can begin to get some of the known dangerous chemicals out of children's products and give parents the information they need to make the informed choices about what they purchase. Secondly, we need to encourage substitution of safer alternatives to dangerous chemicals. We don't need to tell manufacturers what to use. They can find that themselves. As a physician, I am very aware of some of the tragic consequences that arose from ignoring the early warning signs of adverse health effects from other environmental toxins, such as lead and tobacco. As stewards of good health, I believe that physicians bear a special responsibility to sound the alarm and help prevent preventable exposures to toxicants. Lead and tobacco are two well-known cases in which early warning signs were ignored, mostly due to strong resistance from manufacturers. Lead in gasoline was first recognized as neurotoxic in the 1920s. Tobacco was recognized to have serious health effects long before the 1960s. Hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children suffered from these substances needlessly because they were avoidable problems. And millions of dollars have had to be spent in health, in cleanup costs, as well as special education for children who were mentally diminished by lead exposures. I imagine we would all agree that it would have been simpler to act sooner, despite the arguments that we are hearing again today, such as you need more research, experiments in animals are not enough. If it were really a problem, the federal government would take care of it. Who can forget the image of the tobacco executives swearing that they didn't know that nicotine was addictive? You need to know, it has been mentioned by some of the other testifiers, that infants and children are a good deal more vulnerable than adults to the effects of environmental toxins found in the food, the water, the air, and the dust, as well as the manufactured products to which they are exposed. Children have several biological characteristics that make them more vulnerable, such as immature digestive systems with more surface area to absorb toxicants, such as lead. Children will absorb 50% of the lead that they ingest, where adults will only absorb 10%. The livers and kidneys that metabolize and excrete these substances are immature, and that's why it's not till age 3 that some of them can handle these substances well. They accumulate more because they take more in and they excrete less. The brains are more sensitive and are developing, and they don't have the barrier that keeps toxins out the way that adult brains do. So during critical periods of development, neurodevelopment, they're very vulnerable to the damaging effects of these toxicants. Lungs absorb more inhaled toxicants per unit of body weight, and they're often inhaled with dust, and the dust is much greater in concentration close to the ground where they breathe than up here where we breathe. It also accumulates with the toxicants in carpets. And as you know, children have behaviors that involve putting things in their mouth and picking up things from the ground. Their immune systems are also more vulnerable at critical periods. As a result of all these factors, children absorb and retain a much greater proportion of toxicants at a given exposure level than adults. And as has been stated, most safety levels have been set for adult men some time ago before more recent evidence has accumulated. As these bills suggest, the problem goes way beyond lead, mercury, and tobacco. Some newly recognized substances in the plastics that are specifically manufactured for children, baby bottles, toys, lotions, powders, contain bisphenol A and phthalates. We believe these substances cause serious health risks for children. The substances are addressed in these bills. And we believe it because of research that is accumulating every day. Research from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, indicates that 95% of us contain bisphenol A in our bodies at levels above those currently accepted as safety thresholds set by the EPA. Children have more than adults and adolescents. The safety levels are based on old research, and there are many scientific studies suggest that they are not correct, and many scientists who agree when they review the literature. And, of course, there is very strong supporting evidence in animal research. But there's new stuff in human research as well. I do have a degree in chemistry, and I know what BPA is. It's the backbone of the polycarbonate plastics used in baby bottles and water bottles and sippy cups, and the companies that have replaced it with something called copolyester, just a different plastic, is my understanding. They found those alternatives because they needed to. People, when they knew about this, didn't want to buy the other things. A recent study just last month or in January from the Journal of the American Medical Association peer-reviewed studied people with all different levels of BPA and found an increased prevalence of cardiovascular disease, adult onset diabetes, liver enzyme abnormalities in people with the higher levels of BPA, even when they factored in age, race, socioeconomic status, educational levels. These BPA levels were representative of those of the average U.S. population. And this adds again to the studies showing similar adverse effects in laboratory animals. The legislation that you're looking at is aimed to protect children who are at the highest risk in our population. It will allow public policy to begin to catch up with scientific knowledge. I know, well, we stand at a threshold of opportunity now to limit the damaging effects of these substances based on good science. We can reduce the exposure of future generations to these chemicals. This could be as significant as the public health advances made when we realized the need for clean water. By passing this legislation, we will encourage industry to find and use safer alternatives. As I said, this has already been done for some polycarbonate plastic products. Our children need your support. I urge you to support this reasonable legislation and put Oregon in a leadership role for the better health of our population.
Thank you. I'm going to hold questions until after the panel is completed, so we can hear your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Mae Thompson. I am co-chair of the Cabinet on Health Policy for the Oregon Nurses Association. I am a long career in public health nursing. I quit working for money about 12 years ago to have a couple of kids and continue to work with ONA as a volunteer in their health policy program and have been for the past 10 years their unofficial environmental health policy wonk. And I wear that title proudly. I'd really like to thank you, Vice Chair Riley. I see Representative Holby has stepped out of the room, and distinguished representatives for this opportunity to present testimony on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of HB 2367, the Kids Safe Products Act. I'm going to kind of skip the second paragraph of my testimony, which talks about how vulnerable children are, because we've heard a lot about that, and I think you get it. Phthalates are added to polyvinyl chloride plastics to make them flexible. They leach out of the PVC over time, the rate of which is increased by heat, strongly acidic or basic chemicals, or fat-soluble chemicals. I have personal experience with this in my fish tank tubing. You buy fish tank tubing off a roll at the aquarium store, and you put it on your fish tank, and it goes, depending on if it's getting hit by sunlight or whatever, 3 to 5 years, and then it gets really stiff and yellow and ugly. Well, that's because the phthalates have gone out of it. That's what they do. They make that tubing flexible. Phthalates do get into your body and into the maternal bloodstream through the placenta and into the fetus, where they are found in concentrations greater than the maternal circulation, because the fetal liver doesn't get rid of them. Unlike other bad actors, phthalates do not persist in the bloodstream or bioaccumulate in the food chain. They're metabolized in the liver of an adult and excreted in about 4 days, but they're so ubiquitous in our human environment that the National NHANES, National Human Health Assessment, Nutrition,
something like that. It's been going on for about 30 years. Study found phthalates or their metabolites in about more than 75% of the population that was tested, and this is both blood and urine. While much of the science on phthalates considers exposure from one monomer, a kind of phthalate at a time, including the federal science that's been done on this, we must keep in mind that children and all of us are actually exposed to multiple subphthalates at a time, and very little research has been done looking at the concatenation of all of these monomers and metabolites. So that is a particular concern to me as a scientist. Children are exposed to phthalates by absorption through their skin on contact with fragranced personal care products such as lotions, soaps, or powders. Ingestion by mouthing articles containing PVC that we've talked about, and inhalation of fumes from vinyl household items such as PVC plastic furniture covers and shower curtains. In 2001, the federal FDA issued an advisory to healthcare providers that DEHP, a phthalate found in medical IV and other tubing, and in fact in a plethora of products in the medical setting, should not be used for male fetuses, male neonates, and male adolescents. DEHP is linked to liver cancer. That's pretty clear, and at that time was a suspected endocrine disruptor. Subsequent studies in humans indicate that phthalates are indeed endocrine disruptors and are a prime suspect in the increasing rate of hypospadias, a congenital anomaly found in boys. There's also evidence that it interferes with the production of viable sperm in older males. Reproductive age males. In 2007, a study was published that implicated phthalates in the increased obesity and insulin resistance, a precursor of diabetes, in adult males. There's also evidence that phthalate metabolites interfere with thyroid hormone expression in adult males. Now, this is particularly concerning. Most of the endocrine disruptors that we know about disrupt the androgen-estrogen axis, that part of your body that deals with those hormones. Once you start messing with the thyroid hormone, and there's actually a lot we don't know about the way thyroid hormone works in your body, you're not only messing with the things we know about thyroid, like metabolism and weight and insulin resistance and some of these other things, but you're really starting to mess with the development of the brain. We know from hundreds of years ago that small isolated populations that live in areas that don't have a lot of iodine in the water have problems with mentally retarded kids. And when you start messing with the thyroid axis, even very subtle effects, you can start getting these really weird things that we have, no doubt partly because of better diagnosis, but Asperger's and the very severe autism that we're starting to see. Every class in my kids' school in Portland has somebody with autism in it who's affected enough that they need a paraeducator in that classroom. This is a middle-class school. It's really scary. Anyway, you start messing with the thyroid axis and all bets are off. It gets very, very concerning to health professionals. In addition to its endocrine effects, phthalates are also respiratory and dermal irritants and have been implicated in the increased incidence and severity of asthma, eczema, and other allergic syndromes in both children and adults. Now, you've heard about bisphenol A, and I'm going to kind of skip that paragraph as well. The funny thing about bisphenol A is we're not quite sure how the exposures are happening. All pathways seem possible. Ingestion in food, inhalation of BPA in house dust, and actually there was a recent small study done that implicated that, and absorption through the skin. Bisphenol A also crosses the placenta and is found in breast milk. It's metabolized in the kidneys. And over 90% of the people in the U.S. over 6 in the NHANES study have detectable levels of bisphenol A in their system. I will agree with my colleagues from the Chemical Council that the fact you find it there doesn't mean that it's causing harm, but just the thought of it in there is, frankly, a little creepy-crawly. And there's so much we don't know about this stuff. Last year, the Federal National Toxicology Program reported that human studies, while suggestive rather than conclusive, indicate links to infertility, polycystic ovary syndrome, higher levels of testosterone and related behavioral aggression, miscarriage, endometriosis, and endometrial cancer. That's really worrisome.
Studies on animals also implicate bisphenol A as a reproductive toxicant affecting the development and survival of the fetus and neonates, a thyroid disruptor, a possible carcinogen, and a potential neurotoxicant related to several neural and behavioral defects, including hyperactivity and aggression. Now, you can't, because we have 90% of the population with this stuff, there's no control group. And epidemiology is the science of correlation, not causation. The Surgeon General found in 1965 enough evidence to alert the American public about the dangers of cigarette smoking. It was only in the early 90s when we found the molecular mechanism on which cigarette smoke causes cancer. So you don't, when you're making policy, you don't need the molecular mechanism. You just need enough epidemiology to say, hey, there's something going on here. We're worried about it. Protecting environmental public health saves lives and money, according to OEC's Oregon Environmental Council's February 2008 report. The price of pollution, Oregonians spend at least $1.57 billion annually on preventable disease caused by pollution. This includes direct costs such as hospitalization and indirect costs such as special needs education and lost earning potential. Typically, decision makers consider only upfront costs in implementing environmental health protection measures designed to reduce pollution, ignoring the financial impacts of that inaction. Economists call that externalizing the cost. And yes, it's going to cost a lot to act in a precaution way, but in not very long of a time, I would hazard a prediction that you're going to start seeing some savings on at least hypospadias surgeries in this state, which would be great. I'm going to, again, skip my last paragraph because there's hopefully some information from other states. I'd also like to make some comments on House Bill 2792. My comments also are in front of you. And attached to those, oh, by the way, attached to my testimony on 2367 are 10 things you can do to avoid phthalates and bisphenol A in your everyday life. It's on the goldenrod page. I would like to make some comments on the House Bill 2792, and I see you looking at the clock, so I'm going to kind of jump ahead to absolutely applauding this this proposed legislation. I would like to make a few friendly suggestions that might increase the effectiveness of this bill in protecting Oregonians' health and wellness. I'm assuming there's a legal definition of child up to 18 years of age. I would like to remind you that the child starts in the mom, and actually if you take it back, we're finding out more and more about men's health and the contribution to the fetal and the health of the fetus and the child, and a good example of that is the addition of folate or vitamin B6 to enriched food products because it protects against neural tube defects. And so I would really like us to consider children, remind you that children are the canaries in the coal mine, to use a metaphor, but we really should be protecting people of all reproductive age. I would like to encourage you to add a timeline for identifying the chemicals of concern. Section 4 asks the Department of Health Services to identify priority chemicals that pose a significant risk to kids, and this is terrific. ONA would like to see a time certain for at least the preliminary report. 6 to 18 months, given the state of the literature, is probably doable. Another suggestion would be to bring a report back to the 2011 legislature. Another aspect I'd like to address is defining what's publicly available. This is Section 5, Number 2. One thing I've learned in ONA about trying to teach patients about mercury and fish consumption is that a government's agency's perception of what is public information is very different from the public's knowledge of a particular health concern. Advisories available on the web or disseminated through the provider network are only a start, and we really need to think about some kind of greater educational effort or labeling further down the line, availability in multiple languages. There's a number of things nurses and health educators can help with there. Also, please define or refine the definition of a minor volume in Section 5, Number 2. The requirement to report the presence of a chemical of concern is waived if the chemicals are present in a minor volume. Most of the chemicals of concern that we're talking about, I should say many of them, are endocrine disruptors, and they actually have adverse effects at very low concentrations, often in the microgram or parts per billion range. The phenomenon of endocrine disruption really belies the traditional toxicologic adage that the dose makes the poison. The dose relationship in endocrine disruptors is actually a non-linear curve, and there's actually only one statistical test that tests for significance for non-linear curves. At least there was only one presented to us in my doctoral program. These chemicals are not, as is sort of counterintuitive, most active at the highest end of their dosages, but rather sometimes at the smallest or the greatest end. There's different U-shaped curves. There's upside-down U's and regular shaped U's, but the point being that we always think of these nice linear curves, and it's actually different than that in the case of endocrine disruptors. Someone's already asked that the DEQ be involved, and I would second that. They bring particular expertise to this area. And finally, I would like to thank you all for listening to my testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions, Representative Widener?
Thank you, Chair Hobie. And May, thank you for bringing up the fact that we have to be ready for children in the mother's womb as well. So, and I really appreciate Susan coming up here from my district, so, and actually being our chemist for us. I looked up copolyesters because I got that advantage having a laptop here, and it looks like we have polyethylene in the copolyesters that we have to deal with as well, so there's some chemicals there that we're going to have to look at. So looking at this right now, it seems like something that might benefit us is just looking at avoiding infants to the exposure of the BPA at this time, from everything I'm hearing from you, if that's correct, Susan.
I agree. I would use glass baby bottles again.
May I speak? I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Paul F. Widener, I'm sorry I get excited about this because I'm very passionate about it. I think part of the problem with thinking about just the baby bottles is that bisphenol A is also a component of the coating inside canned foods, so that I actually encourage my patients and the people I'm teaching about this stuff to use powdered formula on the theory that they're not going to get the amount of bisphenol A in the can that leaches from the can. You probably know formula is a very high-fat food. You don't heat the formula in the can, but you're still heating it when you produce it, and you are that is leaching out. So there's a concern beyond just baby bottles. It's also used in dental sealants. This is the stuff dentists paint on kids' teeth to prevent cavities. I have to say that my daughter did have a deep crease in her tooth, and the dentist was concerned about it. And I did say, okay, paint that crease with this stuff, but I didn't want him doing the full bore mouth thing on it. So that there's quite a bit of it's actually fairly complicated, and there's quite a bit of education that we need to do for the public on this issue.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. Since we heard some of this in our bills that we heard last week, I replaced all my plastic containers with glass over the weekend.
Representative Krieger.
On your yellow sheet, the bottom PVC, number three,
mm-hmm.
All the PVC pipe is what it's called, water pipe.
Is it, right.
What's that compared to anything else? Because all the cities are replacing their pipe, old metal pipe, with that.
Yes, and it is somewhat of a concern. I'm much more worried about the soft PVC because the phthalates in the PVCs are softeners. They're put into plastic specifically to make it soft. So your IV bags, you want them to collapse as the fluid's dripping in. The tube, you don't want somebody trying to, you know, use one of those uncomfortable things that we have to use in bed when we can't get out of bed while they're stuck to this, you know, some sort of weird glass tube. You want that tubing to be flexible. So it's the softeners that we worry about. My understanding is that while PVC pipe does include some phthalate in it, that it's the soft stuff that's really the concern. For instance, IV tubing that contains PVC is up to 40% PVC. It's a lot.
It's a lot of stuff, and that's one of the reasons we like to change that tubing every 24 or 48 hours, depending on the protocol in the facility.
Thank you. Follow up?
I'll let it go.
Representative Laird?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ladies, I just would like to get a reaction to a thought that part of what we have to do when we're evaluating any product is to match the potential costs to the benefits as well. And things that have been coming to my mind as we've been talking is, for instance, we give immunizations to children, and yet we know that a small percentage of children are going to have a negative reaction to those immunizations. That's a pretty heavy cost for the folks that incur that. And yet we make a judgment that the upside of having those immunizations benefits society and far more people on the whole. You know, I'd love to introduce you to millions of men, women, and children in Africa who would love to have residual elements of DDT in their fatty tissue, but I can't because they're all dead from malaria. So I just want to throw out there that if you know, when we as a government are evaluating the potential hazards, and there are even automobiles, we lose thousands of people every year from automobiles, and yet one could make a very good argument that automobiles enhance our mobility in our life, and they provide all sorts of potential benefits as well. So if we are going to evaluate a particular chemical and its use in society, I think that it's critical that we have a full understanding of the way that we're all benefiting from. And you began to describe in some ways how it's used as a softener. And what would it be like to not have those? And why are they added in the first place? And there may be some food safety and sanitary reasons why these things occur. Just to finish my thought here, my colleague, had mentioned that the PVC piping is replacing what was metal piping. And we have a very good reason, I would think, for wanting to change that out to PVC. But the PVC itself might have a potential downside. But I guess I'm just trying to throw out there that this isn't really about, and this goes back to my question about whether or not the standard should be causes no harm. Because I'm not sure we benefit as a society by having a standard of causes no harm. Thank you.
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, the people wouldn't die from malaria if we eradicated mosquitoes, which is what we're doing. DDT is not the only solution, and that's my answer to your question. It's not simple. You're absolutely right. We weigh benefits and risks, and if there are risks with one thing, we probably can find a better way to do it. And I think that that can hold all the way across the board. As for immunizations, I saw a 14-year-old die of measles who wasn't immunized. And the risks are small but real for people who have immunizations. I think they're greater for a population that isn't immunized. It's known to be far greater.
Agreed.
I really appreciate your testimony. And thank you for appearing for our committee this afternoon. It appears you're both very passionate and knowledgeable about your fields, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have two people left signed up to testify, Richard Kosasan and Matt Wallace. Or maybe it's not Richard Kosasan. Maybe it's Richard Knopsbell.
Thank you.
We can make Kosasan do it.
I don't want to hear that. Get up here, Richard.
Is there a Richard Knopsbell? Knopsbell? Well, I tried.
Richard?
Oh, wait. Are you signed up?
No.
That was pretty funny.
He was jumping on it, though.
If you keep calling up here, he'll come.
Chair, does this mean I get twice the time?
No.
Nice try, man.
I will keep my my spoken comments brief for the record. Again, my name is Matt Wallace, consumer advocate with Osperg. We come at the issue of product safety through work that we've done almost since we've been around as an organization for the last 23 years, doing an annual survey of toy safety for products that are commonly available on store shelves. In 2008, we released our 23rd annual toy safety report. And we're reminded in that through that work that children's products really ought to be safe. And of course, while many are, we know that there are significant concerns left for the safety of children's products, both toys and other products like baby bottles and things intended for the use of very young children. And again, I think the context for our approach for product safety overall has really been reinforced by the just huge wave of product safety issues that we've seen nationwide over the last couple of years, with over 45 million toys and other children's products being recalled in 2007 and continued recalls through 2008. So we know that these hazards are out there, and again, through the work that we've done every year through our annual Toy Safety Report, we've began to focus more, in addition to product safety concerns through choking hazards, small magnets, and other issues, but more and more on the toxic chemical concerns that exist in children's toys and in children's products. So I won't go over, I won't recatalog for you the actual, the full-on health and scientific concerns that arise from the use of chemicals like bisphenol A and phthalates. I think folks like Dr. Hackenmiller-Paradis and the representative from the Oregon Nurses Association, as well as others, have done a much better job than I could at really getting into the details on what these actual concerns are. But we know that these chemicals are found in just about everybody's bloodstreams and everybody's urine, and huge maybe not amounts, but huge instances across populations. And we know that evidence continues to mount that phthalates and bisphenol A could be altering the hormones and harming the reproductive systems of babies and have other significant health effects down the line. And in fact, there is debate on the science. We do respectfully disagree with the American Chemistry Council's conclusion that the weight of evidence approach, shows that there is no risk to these chemicals. Literally hundreds of studies show the dangers. And in fact, in 2005, there was a study, a review rather, of the existing scientific literature, published in 2004, that of 152 studies looking for some harm as a result of low-dose exposure to bisphenol A specifically, 129 found some adverse effect, and only 33 found none, including all 12 of the industry-funded studies. So we do believe that the weight of evidence approach strongly supports regulating dangerous chemicals like bisphenol and BPA. And we think that, very respectable entities are, of course, also backing that up, including last spring the National Toxicology Center of the Toxicology Center of the National Institutes of Health, and pieces in journals like the American Metal Association. A side note, actually, accompanying that piece in the AMA last September was a piece that was questioning a lot of the FDA's process when they came to the conclusion that bisphenol A specifically proposed no specific health risk. I was actually, that's something to look up, the actual citation there, when my computer made a loud beeping noise and shut itself off. So I'm happy to try to follow up with that particular citation. So, those are the things that I wanted to hit. You have my written comments here. We strongly support both bills in terms of outlawing specific dangerous chemicals that we know to be a concern, and the process of allowing the state to really make a better database of the chemicals that we suspect or may need to start to suspect are posing significant health problems, and allow them to require safer alternatives when that's practicable. And then the final thing I'll mention in response to actually Representative Widener's earlier question about studies that look at whether BPA can really leach out of baby bottles and other products when heated or otherwise treated. I know of at least one study that actually did look at that and found a much increased rate of leaching when you actually start heating or brushing or otherwise using, essentially, these consumer products for their intended purposes. Now, again, I'm happy to follow up with a specific citation for that if that's of interest to you as well. So I'll wrap up my spoken comments there in the interest of time, and again, just urge the committee to support both bills, and you know, certainly appreciate and thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about the issues.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. I would ask that if you could provide us not necessarily a copy of the review, at least where that review is from, and so we could find it, the review that published in 2004 that
sure.
looked at all 152 studies.
I'm happy to do that. I left the citations off my testimony in the interest of space, but I can provide a
link if
cited
it
copy.
Exists.
Yeah.
What's that?
A link if it exists.
I'm not sure about a link, but I can certainly get a citation for you. So.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Tomei.
This isn't really a question, it's a statement, so I'll wait until the questions are through.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Someone gave me this, and I don't know who, but whoever gave it to me, everybody on the committee should have one of these. But on page 31 of this little booklet, it says that the federal law, which controls the chemicals, regulating chemicals, is the Toxic Substances Control Act. Under this act, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, cannot require data assessing the health and safety of a chemical prior to its use in products with which we have contacts. This law requires certainty of harm before actions can be taken to prevent harm. Even when the EPA has information on a chemical's potential health effects, the agency cannot share it publicly or with state agencies because that federal law, TSCA, has deemed that this information is confidential business information, and it has not been updated in 30 years.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a pretty interesting statement you just read. I would hope that maybe Victoria could copy that from you if we can't obtain it ourselves.
I think everybody, whoever gave you this, everybody here should have this booklet.
Yeah, okay. Somebody will tell me it's in my packet probably. But
we're going to get one, I can tell.
So I appreciate that. And just for the record, committee, I do want to acknowledge that Randy Tucker from
Metro
turned in testimony in support of House Bill 2792. So you should also have that in your packet. So, committee, we certainly have heard a lot on this issue around hazardous substances, toxic materials, and in these two specific bills today in reference to those some specific chemicals, and then in general the ability of the state to look at chemicals in general in relationship to children products. I encourage you to review everything you've gotten and anything else you can find out about this subject and continue to think about it. My intention will be to have another hearing on this issue. I have not scheduled it yet, but we will be taking another look at it. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2367 and close the hearing on House Bill 2792. Appreciate all the testimony today. Appreciate the committee's attention to this. And I will close the public the committee on consumer protection. Or